Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. Continuing with our Mother's Day celebration, this morning we will be talking about a special Mother's Day initiative, Knit One, Bless Two, with number one New York Times and USA Today bestselling author Debbie Mikomba. Debbie is an author of the best-selling Blossom Street books and Cedar Cove series, and is one of the leading voices in women's fiction today. Her work has debuted in the number one position on every major bestseller list, including those of the New York Times, USA Today, and Publishers Weekly. She is a multiple award winner, and there are more than 140 million copies of her book in print worldwide. And as an additional treat this morning, we will also be discussing her latest book, Hannah's List, A Letter of Love, which just came out this month. Good morning, Debbie, and welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm great, Johnny. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I have to tell you, I enjoy reading your book. I have not finished it, but it's been a while since I read a book about, it's a fiction book, but it's fascinating. What's amazing about it is that you brought life to all the various characters, and I really enjoyed it, and it reminded me of the time when I was getting into reading at junior high. As a matter of fact, of course, I was reading Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew, and those kind of things. And then I got away from reading because, those kind of books, because I was into more like facts, nonfiction.
Yeah.
And it's very, very different compared to what you're doing, and I'm so excited. It's sort of brought back lots of wonderful memories for me, and that's just wonderful. But let us start with talking about a little bit about yourself. Debbie, please walk us through your life's journey from childhood to the present moment.
Well, I'm old, so
Oh, come on now. You're only as old as how you feel.
Oh, that's true. That is so true. I guess because I'm on the road for 5 weeks, I'm feeling older by the day. I've always wanted to be a writer. When I started off, the first book ever given to me was in a library, because I grew up at a time when there weren't a lot of children's books, and my mom took me to the library for the first time, and even then I had a creative imagination, because it was one of the old Dale Carnegie libraries that are built on these big stone blocks. Mm-hmm. And to me, it resembled a castle, and I felt like a princess walking into the castle. And the librarian gave me a book, and my mom said that I grabbed hold of it with both hands and put it right next to my heart. And the interesting part of that story is that the librarian's name is Beverly Cleary, and she's mm-hmm. a well-known children's author even now. Mm-hmm. So I'd always thought about being a writer, and words were, I had a love-hate relationship with words. I loved story, but I had trouble reading. I can remember how excited I was to go to school because I could learn to read the words of the stories. But when I got there, I couldn't read, and no matter how hard I struggled, I had a hard time understanding how to sound out and read words. It wasn't until I was in the fifth grade that I actually learned how to read. And I never told anybody I wanted to be a writer. That dream was so fragile, Johnny, that I was afraid the minute I told even my best friend, oh, someday I want to write books, they would give me all the reasons why it wouldn't work for me. You know, you're not a good student. I wasn't a good student. So I held that dream, and the way I explain it to others is, if you burn yourself or hurt yourself, it will throb with pain. But when I thought about being a writer, I throbbed with joy. It was just like a happy anticipation. But I barely graduated from high school. I was fortunate to have graduated from high school. I married as a teenager. Wayne and I had 4 children in 5 years, but that dream would not go away.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a death in our family. A cousin I had grown up with and was very close to died of leukemia. And that was the year we both turned 30. And it was as if God was saying to me, you cannot, and it's very easy when you have a dream that seems impossible to shove it into the future. Mm-hmm. And I was very comfortable doing that. When the kids are grown or when the kids are, you know, when Wayne and I are settled and secure and, you know, all the different reasons and justifications why I couldn't be a writer. But after David's death, we rented a typewriter. And mm-hmm. we had to rent a manual one because we couldn't afford the rental fee on an electric one. I wrote 8 books on that typewriter until the S went kapooey. You know, it just kind of refused to work anymore. So that's how I got started.
That's fascinating. It seems like everybody has a talent. My mom always told me, my adopted mom in Malaysia, she has always said that, you know, in every one of us there's a seed of greatness. And the seed of greatness is the key to our successes, and it's how we work this seed of greatness that makes a difference. And it sounds like even though you had that sort of a difficult, you know, years in the very beginning of your life, but it did not hamper you from a certain determination within to make, you know, a difference, that you knew that you have a different calling. And I think that makes a big difference because you followed that, and you know, it doesn't matter how long it took, but obviously you found a niche, you know, because we're all gifted in some ways, and
yeah.
So that's fascinating. And I mean, that's just the beginning for you, because you have a very humble beginning as an author. You had a long walk before you became the number one New York Times and USA best-selling author. Tell us a little bit more about that journey, because I think that's fascinating, because a lot of people sometimes don't realize that, you know, we live in a sort of a instantaneous world now.
Yes.
Everything is, like, zap it to me now.
Yes,
and it doesn't work that way.
I think it was Carrie Fisher, the daughter of Debbie Reynolds, who said, mm-hmm. instant gratification takes too damn long. I love that quote. I do want to back up for just a minute, if you don't
sure.
mind, and
yeah.
and say that knitting saved me as a child. It really did. It was the one bright spot in my childhood. And my mom took me down to a yarn. I pestered her all one summer. I don't know why I wanted to learn how to knit. The love of craft, I'm sure, came from my grandmother, but she mm-hmm. died before I have any memories of her. But my mm-hmm. older cousins tell me that she would be in a rocking chair crocheting, snoring, and rocking in a rocking chair, snoring mm-hmm. and crocheting all at one time. So that's, and my mom took me down to the yarn store, and I learned to knit. And it gave me an identity. It gave me some badly needed self-esteem. As you can imagine, growing up and being so frustrated with words and learning
right.
and the concepts, you know, I'm dyslexic, but they didn't have a word for it. It gave me such badly needed self-esteem. And when I would get real frustrated, and to this day I do this, if I get upset about something, I'll sit down and knit. I kind of process life through yarn and needles. And
yeah. Well, that's your therapy in some ways, like what people would say, you know, a quiet moment for yourself to reflect back, and it's like almost meditating. It's very soothing for you.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. That is it. That's how I use it, and I always have. And at the same time, I'm creating beautiful projects to show my love for others. So so knitting has had a very strong and powerful impact in my life. When I started off, I sold the first book after 5 years, 4 manuscripts I wrote, and I joke, but it's so close to the truth, you wouldn't believe it. And I say that the rejection letters hit me in the back of the head on the way home from the post office. And it took me a long time to sell that first book, and there were some very dark moments and deep valleys in that time. My husband was a construction electrician. Could not count on him working all year long. He could work about 9 months out of the year if the economy was good. Winter months were always difficult. And Wayne was a fabulous support for me. I don't know that I could have ever had this dream if I hadn't married Wayne, because he was very encouraging and supportive. And I would get rejection letters. He would hug me and say, you know, it's okay, honey. Keep going. So I'm fortunate to have that. But I sold the first book in 1982, September 29th, 3:49 in the afternoon. And my first book was known as a category romance. Now, what that means is if you go to the grocery store, you will see books that have titles on them like Harlequin Romance or Silhouette Special Edition, and they're treated like magazines. They're out. I used to say my books have the shelf life of cottage cheese because they're out just for a certain time, and then they go. And they print as many copies. If you're this is your first book or your 100th book, you have the same number of copies as everybody else that month. And it wasn't until the early 90s that I decided I would go to a publisher that had mass paperback where the book stayed out longer, the stories were longer. And then eventually I went to hardcover. So it's been just a progression through the years. Like you said, it's been a long journey. I've been published almost 30 years now.
It's fascinating. I mean, reading your bio and the things that you've gone through in life and things that you do, and you're pretty much regimented, though, now. I mean, that's the life journey that we talk about, that sometimes we don't realize that what we're going to be doing tomorrow, we don't realize what we're going to be doing if we don't have today. And the way you walked it and you stayed focused and having all those rejection letters and whatnot and so forth, but you stayed on, truth to yourself. And I think the unique thing, the gift that you have, obviously, in reading your book, what fascinates me the most is because my godmother is actually a screenwriter, and I cannot, you know, like I always tell Anne, I say, you know, I cannot do what you do because you having this sort of internal conversation with all the different characters, different things that you do and everything else, and that's what you brought to life in the books that you wrote, and it's fascinating to me. To me, that's just it's just wonderful. You know, like, do you find that you spend a lot of time by yourself in some ways?
You know, somebody was mentioning just recently what a solitary career writing is, and I've never thought of it that way, Johnny, because I'm surrounded by characters. You know?
Right. Because you have all these, you know, people around you, and you get into it. And we'll get into that a little bit later in the show, but I just wanted to mention that because it just sort of, you know, it just adds something beautiful, and it kind of went into, and I'll mention that later in the show, because how it tied in into, you know, what my concept of, you know, motherly love and everything is all together. But I do want you to talk to us about, you know, you have a very interesting typical day, which I think is very, very fascinating, and I think our listeners would like to hear about that because it's unique, and I mean, it's you. And I think it's very, very interesting, and I think they'll enjoy hearing that.
Well, my normal day starts early. Well, except when it just depends on the road because every day is different on the road because I'm on tour right now. But generally, I get up about 4 a.m. in the morning, and I'm a morning person. I'm just a happy morning person. My poor husband has had to deal with this our entire marriage. There's two kinds of people in the world, the people that get up and say, good morning, God, and then other people that get up and say, oh, good God, morning.
Yeah.
And I'm one and Wayne's the other. So I get up, and the first thing I do is I have what I call my quiet time. Mm-hmm. And it's about an hour and a half to 2 hours long every day. And I just get ready for my day. I read my Bible. I have about three or four different journals I write in and books that I read. And then once I'm finished with that, I go to the swimming pool, which is about, 2 or 3 miles from our house. Mm-hmm. And there's a group of people I swim with every day. They're some of my best friends. And I swim half a mile, and then I come home and change clothes, dress, have breakfast, and head to the office. The office is about 5 miles from the house, and I have a staff of five now. And I go, and the first thing I do is read all of the guest book entries, and I get anywhere from 150 to 700 a day. And these are people who have gone to my website, debbiemaycomber.com, and there's a guest book entry there where they fill in information and can leave me a note. And oftentimes they have a question they want answered. I have staff that does that. And I also read all the letters. The readers have changed the course of my career from their comments about four or five different times. Their information that they give me, their comments, I take seriously and are of great value to me. After I have read all the guest book entries and all the letters, I go up to my office, and which I write in a turret. I get this. I write above a yarn store, and an ice cream parlor. Mm-hmm. I think this is heaven. And then I'll start in on my chapter, and I have so many pages I want to write for the day. I have a page goal, mm-hmm. and when I don't leave until I'm finished.
That's fantastic. We have a caller online that would has a question for you. Error code 610, you're on the air with us. Please tell us your name. Hello, error code 610, can you hear me? Hello? Hello, error code 610, do you have a question for Debbie? I guess not. I guess she's just listening. Anyway, let's continue with our conversation this morning. You are a self-confessed knitaholic. I mean, what, you know, you talk about, you know, getting into knitting at a very young age and so forth, and that helps you in writing?
Well, it helps me think out. If I have a plot problem or anything, mm-hmm. I'll sit down and knit and think about it for a while. And that, so I guess you could say it does help me with plotting, but I just love to knit, and I love yarn. Oh, my goodness, I'm such a yarnaholic. I recently somebody wrote me a letter, and they said that they would love to do some charity knitting. Mm-hmm. You were talking about one of your mothers that does the helmet liners for our soldiers in Afghanistan, which is a wonderful thing to do.
Right.
And but she didn't have any yarn. She couldn't afford yarn. And she said, you're always talking about all the yarn you have. Would you mind sharing some of your yarn? And so I wrote her back. And I said, absolutely. I'll go home and I'll mail you some of my yarn. So I went down to my yarn room. Now, Johnny, you can, and this is like half the basement full of yarn. And I went down there, and I have this big table there. And so I took out some yarn. I put it on the table. And then I thought, well, no, I really kind of wanted to use that for something else. So I put it back and got something else. Well, to make a long story short, I ended up buying her yarn because I could not part with a single skein of my own.
Oh, no.
I have enough to do open my own yarn store right in my house. But I could not part with a single skein, so I just went and bought her yarn.
That's amazing. Well, that brings us to, Knit One, Bless Two, Mother's Day Initiative. I read about it. I loved it, and I think it's something wonderful that you do. But please tell us, what is it all about?
Well, charity knitting is a way for us to give of ourselves to others, and there are a number of wonderful charities out there for charity knitting. And it was an idea that came to us as we're celebrating Mother's Day, to bless someone else, to bless a young mother with a knitted item. Mm-hmm. And so there are three. We went carefully chose three different charities. One is called Project Linus, and it's blankets, and it can be knitted, crocheted, quilted, any way you have to make a blanket. The other is called the Binky Patrol, and this is for newborns. And the other is Newborns in Needs. There, a friend was telling me just recently, she was at the hospital, and a young mother had come in and given birth and didn't have a single thing to dress her baby in, not one piece of clothing to take that baby home from the hospital in. And so this provides the Binky Patrol and Newborns in Need. This gives the young mother something that's hand-knit or handmade with love, and they're to mail it into, if they go to bless, Knit One, Bless Two, and it's the number one and the number two, the website, they'll see in the instructions on what to make and where to send it off to New York. And the response has been overwhelming. I'm just, as I'm on tour, I have several of the items that have been hand-knit that I'm showing people at the book signings. And they're just beautiful. The one that I have here is a sweater, and the woman that knit it enclosed a letter with it to the young mother who would receive this sweater. And she said, I knit it with love, and that you can love your baby. And it was it's just a touching, touching letter of caring people reaching out to others.
Well, it's a gift from the heart, so I think that's the uniqueness about this whole thing, because it engages people. And of course, I guess being a young mother, it's very challenging. So when you have someone that just extend that wonderful motherly love, that in itself is a beautiful blanket in itself that helps to cover both, I guess, the infant child as well as the mother that got it, you know. So I think that's what you're doing is just fascinating. You know, you wrote a book about knitting with Debbie, obviously, a charity guide to knitters. I mean, it came out last year, so obviously you have done this over a period of time. Tell us a little bit about that, too.
Well, I have a number of pattern books out. Now, I need to explain. I am an avid knitter, but I'm not a designer. These patterns come from other people. They just attach my name to it. And most of the pattern books go along with the fiction story. So, like Hannah's List, which is currently out right now, there is also a companion knitting book with it that'll take from the book itself ideas, and then the patterns are created by Leisure Arts, who puts together the pattern books. But they like to do two a year, and so I suggested that we do, because on the road, people are like, well, what's your favorite knitting charity, or, you know, who do you knit for? And there are just a number of them, and I thought what we really needed was one central place for people to look at what's possible, what charities are out there, give a pattern for it, and then where they can send it. And I approached Leisure Arts with the idea. They fully endorsed it, and they let me choose the charity. So my assistant, Renata, and I chose the charities together. Mm-hmm. And the patterns are created. So there's just a variety of things in there. So if you're a new knitter, there's something for you. If you're a more experienced knitter, there's something for you to knit to and could give to others. And when you say knit one, bless two, whenever we give of ourselves, we are blessed also. The person who receives it is blessed, and the giver is blessed.
That's correct. Yeah, it's amazing. And sometimes we don't realize that because we're thinking we're just giving, but in return we're actually receiving what we give. I mean, the Bible talks about that. You know, I know that you say you read your Bible every morning, and it gives you that the spiritual grounding, so to speak, and in the things that you do, and in knowing and have been read about you, you know, in so many different things, the things that you've done. I think it's fascinating that I you know, you are championing the concept of motherly love out there, and in a very different way. And we all do things in a different way, you know, based on our ability. But you certainly created something wonderful. Let's talk about Hannah's List. You know, I'm glad you brought it up because one thing that's fascinating to me, again, being just introduced to the way you write and the things that you do. There were a whole lot of knitting and all that kind of stuff in it. So fascinating thing in the sense that you bring all that into your book. And tell us a little bit about how you developed the characters in Hannah's List.
Well, the premise for Hannah's List is based on a true incident. I was having dinner with a friend who was telling me about a friend of hers who had died of cancer, and then before she died, she wrote her husband a letter that said, you know, you're not going to do well as a single man, and I want you to remarry without guilt, and she gave him a list of her friends that she thought would make him a good wife, and I was so struck by that act of love that I decided I would write a book on using the same premise. I made him a doctor specifically, a pediatrician, because the one thing Hannah wants is for her husband to be a father, and she isn't able to give him children, which is how they discovered she had ovarian cancer. He's 35, she's a little bit younger, and here she is, and she's unable to have the children, and then they discover she has cancer. A year, so she's very much a presence in the book, although she's been dead for over a year. Mm-hmm. And he receives a letter from his brother-in-law that she gave him to give to Michael a year after her death. And in the letter, she basically says, my life has ended, yours is going on. I don't want you to grieve for me. I want you to continue. I don't want you to bury yourself in your work. I want you to remarry and have a family. And then she does the same thing. She gives him a list of three women she thinks would make him a good wife. And the way I worked it out, I can imagine how somebody would feel getting a letter like that. So the first person on the list is Winter Adams, who is Hannah's cousin. Mm-hmm. Michael knows her. He's comfortable with her. And it isn't such a leap. The next person is somebody that he knows peripherally. It is Leanne Lancaster, who is or was Hannah's oncology nurse. It was so gentle and sweet and caring person. And then the last person, Michael is convinced Hannah threw it in for comic relief, is this woman by the name of Macy Roth. And Macy is a charming character that he doesn't know her at all, never even heard her name that he can remember, although Macy was very caring towards Hannah when she was dying. And so that's how I chose the three women.
Interesting, very, very interesting. But the way you had tied everything in, from a guy's perspective now, and again, I mentioned to you about not, you know, really reading about romance novels and stuff like that, but what happens here is that the immediate thing after reading about you and your book, I see the common wonderful flow of that unconditional love, you're telling it in a beautiful way, and that's fascinating to me, because what her character does tells me is that unconditional love. But hey, you know, it's okay. You know, go ahead and do what you need to do and what I think you definitely need to do. Plus, not only that, it's like a mom, you want the best for your child.
Yes, exactly. She wants the best for Michael.
Right. So that's fascinating to me in terms of how you're able to incorporate everything in. It's very subtle. Like I said, I'm reading it from a guy's perspective, and, you know, for better or worse, that's my take on it. And having all, you know, I have different moms in my life and that came in different times in my life and helped me to decipher the various challenges in my life. So it's quite fascinating in terms of having the opportunity to read your novel. It's just a beautiful twist. It's just wonderful. Hannah's List obviously touched you in a personal way about one of your friends, Stephanie. What personal message would you like to convey to your readers and our listeners this morning?
Well, I have to explain who Stephanie is. I have a breakfast club. When I first, as I explained, I married as a teenager, and I was a stay-at-home mom, Wayne, and I had the four children in 5 years. Mm-hmm. And when I started out as a writer, I was at the kitchen table with a rented typewriter. But as my career built, I felt the need to get out into the business community, and I rented my first office. I think it was probably about 91, 92. Mm-hmm. And I was having to make business decisions that I felt totally inadequate to make. I had never been in the business world, and I had worked very briefly for an insurance company, but that was it. And so I started, I know enough that if you want to learn, you ask those who have succeeded. So I invited friends or acquaintances that I knew that were successful businesswomen, Betty Roper, who was the bank president. Stephanie Cordell had her own business that was in the same office structure that she had rented office space there. Lillian Schauer was also a friend who had her own business. She's an attorney. Very interesting life Lillian's had. She married at 14, had two children, got a GED, went back to school, became an attorney. But here were successful women. So I invited them to my house for tea to ask them a number of questions about setting up an office, hiring employees, and different aspects of a career. Mm-hmm. And we had such a good time together, we decided to meet every week for breakfast. And that was almost 20 years ago now. So mm-hmm. Here we are. And Stephanie was she thought she'd been bitten by a spider because she had all these kind of weird symptoms. Coming to find out, it was ovarian cancer, and she died just a few months later. And it really struck a chord with us that there were really no symptoms, and it was so hard to lose her.
Right. That's amazing. I mean, I think people don't realize that. I mean, if they don't, you know, sometimes, like you say, in terms of checking things out, and, you know, we take things for granted sometimes, and they are things that you can do out there to follow up, to make sure, you know, to do a medical checkup, I guess, from that perspective, it makes a big difference. And so in your book, I know you mentioned that, and so I wanted to bring that up because I think something that all women need to know.
Yes.
So, but you have a fascinating story, obviously, because she obviously, you know, is at her prime.
She was at her prime. I mean, she was just in her 50s.
Yeah, yeah. And so having that happen, you know, so sort of almost, I presume, blindsided her in some ways. And so that's the difference. So in writing the various books that you've written over the years, you know, it like to say it's almost 30 years now. How has that impacted your life personally as a woman, as a mother, and as a grandmother?
When I started off as a writer, Johnny, I was young, and I was writing romances, basically just straight romances. I always tried to include a bit of humor in there, and, you know, I built the book. And then as I've gotten older and my children, you know, grew up and I became a grandmother, and the stories changed because I changed. You know, I'm growing, I'm maturing, and the storylines changed. So they became more of women's fiction. Is, you know, as a 50 and 60 year old, it's harder for me to write about a 25 year old falling in love for the first time. So I introduced complex life problems into the equation, and so the books have changed as I have changed.
How has that affected you in terms of your thoughts, in terms of when you were developing all these various characters? And we talk about the fact that you were having conversations. You know, you're never alone.
That's true.
And so as you develop, and I know that you picked on, you know, the obviously your life. You met different people and you create this wonderful characters and so forth. How has that enriched your life in terms of knowledge and, say, wisdom and everything else from that perspective?
Well, I think that the wisdom part just comes with maturity. You know, as you grow, you just naturally grow more wiser. Mm-hmm. But I am a storyteller, and story has always been the most important aspect of my career. Mm-hmm. I've had to learn to be a writer. In fact, I have just sort of a feeling about writers. I think there are three different kinds of writers in the world, and the first are the natural-born writers. And you'll know who they are in school because they can just schmooze their way through essay questions. They don't have any problems. And oftentimes, they have such a way with words, the beauty of words and constructing sentences. But almost always, they have a hard time telling a story. They get so caught up in the beauty of creating a visual scene that they lose sight of the forest. So once their storytelling abilities are equal to their writing ability, they sell. I'm just the opposite. I've always been a storyteller. So my stories have always been good. So when my writing abilities, and I had to start right at, you know, basic English, when my writing abilities were par with my storytelling abilities, that's when I sold. Then there are the people that possess both. They're rare and far between, and they sell quickly because they are both a good storyteller and a good writer. But oftentimes, they are one-book wonders because they don't have that I say they haven't suffered enough. And it's true. They really need to have that basic foundation of rejection to build. They've sold. They succeed. They don't know what they did right. And so they often struggle, and you know almost right away. If you know, I could mention just a whole list of authors who have had one book, just one book out, and it was a success. Every other book, it just fell short of it, and there's tremendous pressure they're under. So that's kind of like my theory of the kind of writers there are, which is totally off base of your question.
I think, in reading your book and understanding the way you write over the last several years, as a new writer for myself, I tell you what, you open up a totally new dimension, even though I'm not writing fiction, okay? But it's a different concept, a different approach, and I'm very excited about wanting to develop that. And again, this show is about you, but I just wanted to mention the fact that I've got so much from just having you on the show, you know, from My Mama's Kitchen. It's a concept that I've developed, and you know, and having you know, book two, three, and so forth. But you have given me a way to, I guess, to to really tie in a nice way, because it is a nonfiction book, and to be able to present it in a beautiful way that you did, in the style that you do. The first thing that hit me when I started reading about the things that you've done, Cabot Cove, Maine. When I was a kid growing up, watching Angela Lansbury in Mother, She Wrote.
Yes.
And Cedar Cove reminds me of that. Of course, I guess Cabot Cove, Maine is real, and you also be Port Orchard, Washington. But it created that wonderful feeling of a community, small-knit, good times. And of course, real-life, real situation, you have things happening and everything else. And having you being able to bring life to, you virtually created a village, a town, or whatever you want to call it, and that's fascinating to me.
When I go to develop a story, because like I've said, I'm a storyteller, I've had to figure out a way which stories to develop, because there's stories all over. I mean, I look at life, and everywhere I look, there is a story, and so I had to come up with a way of deciding which stories to develop. Mm-hmm. And because I'm a word person, I do it with words. The first thing I look at when I think of a plot premise, the first thing I do is gauge it against these words. And the first one is relevant. It has to be relevant to my readers' lives. I don't want it to be so far off base that it isn't something that wouldn't happen to them.
Right.
So it's something that's going to come right out of my life, their lives, and they're immediately it's going to hit a chord with them. It has to be wrong.
Right.
It has to be provocative. Mm-hmm. I want them to think. I want to put the reader in a situation in which they're going to think. In a book I wrote called 20 Wishes, I want my readers to come away with the fact that what would they do if they had 20 wishes?
Mm-hmm.
Or with Hannah, if they had a second chance at something or had the ability to give someone a second chance, what would they do?
Right.
How would they go about it?
Right.
So it's relevant. The other thing is it has to be told in the most creative way. When I wrote Hannah's List, I've never done this before. I wrote it first-person male point of view. It starts off with the hero, Michael Everett. The first line is, I'm not a sentimental kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're right there in his viewpoint. And
right.
So I did that in the most creative way I could. And I have to be honest. I can't just tie everything up very neatly at the end of the book with a fancy bow and say, this is how it turns out, and it's all lovely and beautiful. It has to work out. It has to be honest. I want the reader, when they close the book, to have a warm, good feeling that this could happen and it could turn out right.
And that's what I gather, in the sense that you have that sort of, reading your book has a take-home, a wonderful take-home value to it.
That, I've never heard anybody say it like that, but I like that a lot. A take-home value, yes.
Yeah,
exactly.
Because it's applicable to real life, real situation. Regardless whether it's fiction or not, it doesn't matter, because when you watch TV, when you watch a movie, besides seeing the characters, the play, the acting, and all that, there's a story behind it, and if you can engage in it and see the meaning behind the meaning. The stories, that's what the take-home value is. And in reading your book, and that's what the take-home value is that sort of unconditional love, the real-life, real situation. If you have an opportunity to make a positive difference in someone's life, how would you do that?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And the last thing it has to be is entertaining. I mean, I'm asking my readers to plunk down $25 of their hard-earned money.
Yeah.
I want to be value-added. I want them to think, I would spend that money again in a heartbeat to read another one of her stories. That's the feeling I want to leave with them.
Well, you did. I tell you, I mean, it's fascinating. Obviously, you're able to tie, and I love the way that the series on you bringing one character from one to the other and building it up. It's like a daytime soap opera, which is a wonderful, except yours is much more believable, real, and homey and all the above, which is fascinating. I think that's just It's just wonderful. I'm these are the things that I'm getting when I read, and so I enjoy that. How about this? I mean, having that, you're such a storyteller. When your kids were growing up, do you tell lots of bedtime stories, or now, or maybe perhaps now as a grandmother, you do that to your grandchildren?
I used to be the highest paid babysitter in the town I grew up in, Yakima, Washington, because I used to create stories using the kids I was watching as characters.
Uh-huh.
I used to, at the time when it was a quarter an hour, I was getting a dollar. I could command a dollar an hour. So, yes, I've always been that storyteller, and my kids have always been. Now, one of the questions I almost always get from when I do autographings and things is, are any of your kids going to be writers? Mm-hmm. And all four of our children are creative, talented. Mm-hmm. I'm blessed with four just fabulous kids. But none of them have the passion for it, and passion is the key. You have to be passionate about writing. I think maybe a couple of my grandkids would could possibly be writers. They show all the instincts of writers. But yeah, in your book, Johnny, do you have recipes?
Yes, I do have recipes, food recipes, and in this particular one, I started out. Wanting to, this is a guy thing, being selfish, I actually started out wanting to write a food recipe book, and that's why I titled it From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. My mom came here from Malaysia, and she visits me all the time, every so often, and this was back in 1999, and so it was just to a point where I realized that, she's 72, she's not going to be able to, travel that much anymore, so I need to write down all my recipes from her. And then in the course of thinking about that, I knew all the other women that I like their recipes, and I wanted to combine everything together. But before you know it, 7 years went by, and I could never get the book done because it wasn't right, because in the sense that had I just wrote just food recipes that, that you were inquiring about, then I would have left out several women that were very important in my life. Because I didn't really, not necessarily care for their food, but it was more like, they were not the best of the best, so to speak, because I'm doing my thing. Finally, my 90-year-old foster mom, Italian mom from Poplar Bluff, Missouri, called me up in January of 2007 and said, "Hey, are you going to finish the cookbook before I die?" Oh, my God. I said, certainly. I said, it's been 7 years now, so it's like, yes, of course. Definitely. And so I made it upon, took it on my own accord to start writing on April 1st. And I was determined to do that because I sat down every night and meditated and started writing for a couple hours every night. And I finished it in 9 months at the end of the year. I was spiritually driven to write this book because then I realized that, what actually tied all of us in together is the motherly love that I've got from all these wonderful women. Over the years, they all came from different backgrounds. I created the character for them in the sense that I have my ballroom, my late ballroom dancing instructor mom, who taught me ballroom dancing some 12 years ago, 14 years ago in this case, when ballroom dancing wasn't cool, and especially for young guys, because you don't want to tell people that you do ballroom dancing for a guy, single guy, because they think you're conflicted. So I don't, so it's just funny. In the fourth hindsight now, that was the greatest thing that I ever did, because now I can go to any dance situation and I could dance with anyone because I was told, hey, trust us, okay, we are women, we know. You need to learn how to dance and dance well.
That's great.
Yeah. So to answer your question, but in my book I do, the recipes for living are actually motherly wisdom. This wonderful women had imparted to me in helping me in my life, and also I included 9 various recipes from my various moms in the book. But this is just book one, and in book two I'll be expanding it, more and having more recipes, food recipes as well as recipes for living, and so forth. So having said that, that's what it's all about. It's about women empowerment and those kind of things, but it's just a wonderful thing. It's my appreciation for what they have done for me, so to speak.
And with so many women, food is love. You know, it's right. The way we have of expressing love. So recipes are important to us. That is the one thing that links women. For when I do autographings, I give a gift to the reader to thank them for coming. I'm a value-added author. And
right.
For years, I did recipe cards. I would gather my favorite recipes and give them a set of 10 recipes printed out. And the comments I got were, oh, love the recipes. When are you coming to town again?
Right.
So recipes are just so important. And what you're giving there are more than recipes for food. It's recipes for life.
Right. And what happens for me in my situation is I use the kitchen from my mama's kitchen because in the kitchen setting, you know, you have your hair down, so to speak. You could create and converse and relax in a very different atmosphere, environment, and everything else. So it just makes a big, big difference in terms of, you know, how one can connect with one another. I think that makes a big difference, and that's why I use the kitchen as a backdrop. And of course, these women grew up in an era where the kitchen is their main domain. That's where they find their own private own sanctuary, so to speak. And so that makes a big difference for them when they were in the kitchen. And so anyway, so that's why I created that. And I know you are a big, you wrote in your cookbook, one thing that for sure that I would love to cook this holiday is your Christmas beef Wellington.
Oh, I did it last Christmas. I did it myself.
I saw that. I saw that the picture, and I said, I got to have that, period. I'm a meat eater, so that's just amazing, you know.
The picture looks so good. Doesn't it look good?
I know. It's amazing. It was like, okay, this is it. That's it. I got to have that. My Southern Belle mom is an excellent cook, and she, you know, says, you know, like one of the things that she told me, you know, like it's like being a mom is like being in the kitchen. It is always about caring and loving. It requires patience, a happy attitude, and a touch of love. And that's how she does her stuff. She's the only mom, by the way, that I have that actually got me to eat vegetables, believe it or not, and no one else could. And you know, you just can't say no to Eleanor. That's the way I put it.
Well, the idea for my cookbook came right from my readers. All of my good ideas come from my readers. Anytime I would have a recipe or I would mention a food in the Cedar Cult series, especially Terry Polgar's macaroni and cheese, and they would immediately, my office would be inundated with requests, do you have a recipe for that? And so I took that to my publisher and I said, I really think we should do a cookbook. And it has just done phenomenally well. It's a beautiful cookbook. I'm anxious to read your book, too. I'm really anxious to read it, in fact.
I'd be more than happy to send you a signed copy. And after the show, I will email your agent and we'll work all that out and so forth.
Oh,
okay?
I would love that. And I love the whole concept of your book. I just think it's a really wonderful idea from
Thank
my
you
mama's
very much.
Kitchen.
I appreciate that. Well, you know, I mean, I really do. I appreciate that. Coming from you, it means a lot to me. And so I really appreciate it. I'm anxious, actually, to hear your feedback on that, too. So I'm really glad. But let me answer this, too. I know on the lighter side, you know, you see, this is the kind of thing that what I enjoy about you is that you're casual, real life, real person, you know, getting engaged in all kinds of things and so forth. But on the lighter side, you know, among all the many writing awards that you've that you have earned over the years and so forth, but one particular honor kind of stood high among all the rest as being very, very special, the invitation to throw the ceremonial first pitch at a Seattle Mariners game. Please tell us about that. What kind of experience and how was it?
Oh, my goodness. My kids are so funny. They think, you know, well, you know, I'm their mom. They don't think of me as being a celebrity. But when I got asked to throw out the opening pitch at the Mariners game, that stood out in their mind like, whoa, mom. Wow. So, well, unfortunately, when I was asked, I had a torn rotator cuff. But I was not.
Oh, no.
I was not about to let this opportunity pass me by. I didn't care,
right.
Rotator cuff or not, I was doing it. So it was a phenomenal experience. They let me have four people down on the field with me, and it ended up three of my children came, and one of my best friends. It's what they call stitch and pitch night is how I got asked, because I'm a well-known knitter. And so they have the knitters in the stands. And so that's how I it's not because of my sports prowess or anything. They didn't say, wow, she could swim half a mile, and, you know. So,
hey, that's a feat in itself now.
Oh, yeah, don't believe me. I used to swim a mile, but I don't have the time anymore, so I just do half a mile. And I don't know if I have the endurance either.
Half a mile is long enough, I'm telling you. And you're talking about a mile? Oh, God.
Yeah, let me tell you, half a mile in the water is a whole lot farther than a half a mile on land.
I'm sure it is. I am sure it is.
So, but that's how that came about, and it was a lot of fun. In fact, as I'm throwing an opening pitch out again this year at the Tacoma Rainiers, which is a minor team, a minor league team. So my husband says I've been demoted.
Oh, okay.
I've been sent to the minors, but that's all right. I'm still happy to do it.
What you need to do is get the boys out, you know, whether your grandchildren or your son, to come out in the backyard and start, you know, throwing pitches now, so that when you go out there, you know, hey, I can crank it up there.
Well, I'm sure to do better with, you know, a repaired rotator cuff.
There you go. See, you know, it's like last year, you know, you can kind of, you know, when you go out there, you got to have that attitude thing, you know, you got to shake it off on first base, you know, and that kind of thing. And so, you know, get into all that entire character thing, you see. And then you throw a heat right straight down.
Well, when you say get into the character, does that mean I, like, kick the dirt with my feet and
there you go. There you
scratch
go.
My behind?
Yes, you know, and do a little, you know, of course, not tobacco, perhaps, you know, chew gum and spit it a little bit, you know, and kind of really get into it. And I think everyone will get a big kick. I mean, this year, you know, like you say, hey, you know, that the majors, because you know why, like your husband was saying, you are in the minors now, so you got to show up to be called back.
That's right. That's
majors.
Right.
So that would be a wonderful thing to do. Anyway, what's coming up in the horizon for you in for the rest of this year and beyond?
Oh, I have some wonderful things coming up this year. I get a trip to Turkey. They're launching my own brand of collection of yarn. Universal Yarn is going to have a Debbie Maycomber Blossom Street collection. So I'm going to Turkey to visit the yarn mills and see the country where the yarn is being processed and choose some colors. And it's going to be a fabulous trip. I'm taking both my daughters with me, so I'm very excited about that. The second Mrs. Miracle movie will be out with Hallmark. Last year's Mrs. Miracle was the highest-rated Hallmark movie of the year and the fourth highest ever rated. So my readers are very faithful to watch the movies, and they asked me to write another book, which I did, and this one is called Call Me Mrs. Miracle, and that will be out the first week of December. Again, Doris Roberts, who played the mother on Everybody Loves Raymond, will play the role of Mrs. Miracle. So I have some very exciting things coming up this year. And
well,
another movie
in
the works, too.
I'm sorry for interrupting you. You know, I would love to have you back in December when we do our Christmas specials.
I would love that, Johnny. You're a fun person to talk to. I've never been on the radio for an hour before, so this has been quite an experience.
Hey, I enjoy it, too. I'm so glad you do. So I'm sorry. Go ahead. And then what else besides the Call Me Mrs. Miracle?
Oh, there's another movie and that's about to get the green light called Susanna's Garden. And I'm not sure, but I'm sure I think that'll probably be out in 2011.
Fantastic. Congratulations on that. I mean, this
yeah.
is... some wonderful things. Well, how can someone keep up with you and with all your latest happenings and so forth? Do you have a website? I know you mentioned it just now briefly, but you have different websites for different things. So please tell us the various websites that you have.
There's right now there are three websites that are up and running having to do with me and my books. The first one is debbiemaycomber.com, and it's Debbie, and then Maycomber is Macomber.com. And you can go there, and it should be just kind of a fun place to visit. And I blog so that you can catch up with what I'm doing just about on a daily basis. Yesterday was very exciting. I was in tornadoes, so in a shelter, so that was very exciting. And then Knit One Bless Two tells about the knitting charities and how to get involved with that, knitting for others and expressing, giving expression of motherly love to someone else. Mm-hmm. And then the last is hannahslist.com, which is the title of the book. And the reason I mention that is there is a contest in which anybody who enters the contest can win $10,000 for a second chance. All you have to do is tell me in 100 words or less what you would do with a second chance and why you want it. And those are being read and judged, and someone is going to win $10,000 for a second chance.
Fantastic. That's truly wonderful. Well, we're coming close to the end of the show, and as a mother of four and a grandmother of nine, do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with all of us this morning?
I think it's very important to live with passion and to love with passion, with to give yourself to others, because it is in giving that we receive, just like you said. Mm-hmm. And I think, too, it's important to remember who God is and that He is in control and that not we aren't. It's Him.
Fantastic. That's a beautiful recipe for living. And I know that you have basically, you know, lived your life that way, too. So that's the fascinating life that you have lived. Looking back, as far back as you can, how would you summarize your life, in a sense? Do you feel like this is something that you have always envisioned, or is this something that's better than what you could have been? And, you know, life is a journey. How has this been for you?
I think the first part of my life was a struggle, learning in school and different roadblocks that were put in my way. But I've always learned from my parents to have a positive attitude. Mm-hmm. And to be passionate about what I do, just as they were passionate about their own careers. And I think that is, I'm so fortunate to have had the parents I did and to marry the man I did. I mean, I was a teenager when I got married. I had no skills in choosing the right person, and by the grace of God, I did.
Well, how long have you guys been married, may I ask?
It'd be 42 years this year.
Fantastic. That's wonderful. My German mom actually just celebrated their 45th wedding anniversary last year.
Yeah,
so, and you know, you don't hear stuff like that anymore.
not very often. Not very often.
So that's fascinating. I mean, that's wonderful. I mean, one of the main things that one of my moms told me one time is that when we're young, we, you know, and I mentioned this, I'm mentioning this because, you know, you mentioned about, you know, growing up, it seems to always been a struggle, and I think it's always a struggle for everyone. But when we're growing up, you know, when we're young, we learn. When we're old, we understand.
Oh, good point.
Yeah. So I think, you know, when you look at things in life, it's a fascinating thing because there is a cycle, a period that you go through, and God is getting you ready for something else. Because you always think that today, well, this is it right here, that's it. And lo and behold, that's something new and bigger, better, whatever you want to call it, and so forth, that sort of got you in that situation, you know. So that's very, very different.
Oh, good point. I love that. When we're young, we struggle, and when we're older, we understand. That's really good.
Yeah. Well, Debbie, thank you for the great recipe for living again and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us this morning, and please join me next Tuesday morning as we continue with a Mother's Day special, Delivering Hope, The Extraordinary Journey of a Surrogate Mom. My guest will be Pamela McPhee. Pamela and I will be having a candid conversation about her intimate experience as a surrogate mom as we look back and celebrate her personal journey of unconditional motherly love. For additional information about this show, future shows, and for my recipes for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Twitter.com/FMMK Talk Radio. And thank you for listening this morning. Have a great week. And Debbie, thank you again, and have a great day.
Thank you.